Well, it's good to see you this morning. Appreciate the men that filled in for me while I was gone, because many of you, you already have a wife, you have kids, you have a job that's 50, 60 hours a week, and that you said, hey, I've got time to do a class, I can put together a sermon, and so I really appreciate you filling in and doing what you can do. John and Leanne are great people to travel with. We would travel with them again. We're enjoyable, the couple, to share time with. And so that's special. And greetings from the Leeward Church of Christ on Oahu. Greetings from the congregation there. Many of them are Filipino brethren. And so keep that congregation in your prayers. And Daniel Duvall preaches there. And Daniel's a young man who is currently single, but I believe he has a girlfriend. But be praying for Daniel and for his work there. There's a, like a lot of places, there's a lot of work to do. In the book of 2 Kings chapter 5, you go like, well, I know all about this. Good. I want to talk about 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Assyria, was a great man with his master, and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. That's not good. And it's interesting that the Holy Spirit says that the reason that he was victorious and having success is because of God. That not necessarily because of he was so talented and so gifted, but rather because God was using him, and particularly using him to punish Israel at the time, because Israel was not faithful to God at this particular time. It says in verse 2 that they'd gone out in bands and taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife and were never told her name. And it says, she said to her mistress, all right, you ready? You got your pitch? And I don't know if I even like to call it that, because the gospel is not like you're trying to sell someone like a timeshare or, you know, whatever, but I'm just going to use the word pitch. You got your pitch. You might call it, you got your line. Because she had hers. And in the book of Colossians chapter 4 and in verse 6, verse 5 and 6 says, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. I think some of that is, understand when you're around a non-Christian. Hey, you're around an outsider right now. Do you know that? Are you aware of that? Is there an awareness there? And are you making the most of that opportunity? Are you mining that opportunity for all it's worth? And then it says, let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Notice what she says. I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, then he would cure him of his leprosy. She had her pitch. What's yours? She made the most of the opportunity. And when I talk about your pitch, I'm talking about the condensed version. I'm not talking about rambling for 15 minutes. Like the Proverbs are like little bouillon cubes. There's a lot of flavor packed into just a one-line statement. And to me, your pitch should be that way. The thing that you say to people who ask you things like, well, why do you believe in God? Don't ramble for 15, 20 minutes. Have you already got it boiled down and condensed like a proverb is? Where it's just packed tight. No excess words. It gets the point across. And it catches people's attention. Maybe something good to work on this year. Like, when we were traveling, I was telling everyone, hey, this is the first time I've been to the islands, and it's our 40th wedding anniversary. And invariably I got this, what's the secret of being married for 40 years? What if someone asked you that? What's your pitch? What would you say? Would you go like, Or do you have something to say? You got it boiled down. Have you got it condensed? We'd say, this is it. Here it is. Sometimes I'll say, well, we continue to treat each other like company. And another thing I might say, well, I believe I'm going to have to answer to someone someday for how I've treated her. And they go like, oh, yeah. But you got your pitch. That really, it grabs their attention. Why are you a Christian? Why are you a Christian? You got that boiled down to a good, concise answer. What church do you attend? You got that boiled down. I know sometimes I'll be somewhere and, you know, maybe someone will offer me a drink or whatever, or we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. Or they'll say, yeah, I used to, and I was talking to some guy there at the last place we stayed. He was like 70 years old, and he told me his life story, and, you know, and he'd been a raging alcoholic and things like that. And he says, hey, man, before I met my wife, you know, I was drinking till I passed out too, etc. And then I found her more intoxicating than anything I was drinking. Sometimes that's my pitch. And people go, oh, that sounds so romantic. But to me, no one ever argues with me over that. No one ever comes back and says, no, you can have one or two. No one ever has ever argued with that. They've gone like, okay, type of thing. What's your story? Now, this unnamed girl's story could have been, I'm a captive, I'm a slave, I'm oppressed, I'm nobody, my life is over, woe is me. That could have been her story, and probably a number of servants or slaves or captives, that became their story. Taken from my homeland, God has forsaken me. That's their story. You know what her story was? Her story was not, I'm oppressed. Her story is not, I'm a captive, I'm a slave, God has let me down. Her story was, I am from a people that served the true God, and that true God can heal lepers. That was her story. What would you become if you dropped your story? And the reason I say that is over the years I've seen Christians pick up stories that I think are completely detrimental to their Christian growth. And it really, they either fell away because of it. I remember one person's story was that all the churches that we've been to have done us wrong, let us down. And if that's your story, you're probably going to fall away. And it's not true either. That's not completely true. There's more to that story. Everyone hasn't let you down. Well, I'm in love. That could be your story this morning here. I grew up with all sorts of disadvantages. That could be your story. What if you just got rid of that? Just drop that story. I'm dropping. I'm not going to tell that story anymore. What type of person would you become? Really listen to yourself. Listen to yourself. What's the story that... I think with John and Leanne, I think they introduced us to something like, if you're at a table and you start telling a story you've told before, you put a knife across your glass as you're the spectator, letting the person starting the story to know, we've heard that story before. That's the signal. That's the signal. You're starting to repeat yourself and ramble. That's the heads up. We've heard that story before. And maybe you need people in your life like that that just go as you... Maybe there's some story that you just keep telling, going like, you know, we're kind of tired of that story. You probably have relatives and friends and coworkers like that. Maybe it's like, you know, there you go. How about a new one? But I think there's times stories that we need to drop if we're going to move forward spiritually. Your story should be, I'm blessed. I'm blessed to be a Christian.
God forgave me of all my sins. Jesus died for me. I don't deserve it. And I'm going to do everything I can to seek to be the best Christian for the Lord Jesus Christ, because I owe him everything.
I think one way that you would know if you need to drop your story or not, if people walk away after they hear your story going like, man, do I feel horrible. Now, that's probably a story you need to drop. If people walk away going like that, then I think you probably have a pretty good story. But look at your story. What story have you been telling for this last year? So, that's something that impresses me here about this. Okay, now, so, before we get to this one, here's the thing that strikes me, is that immediately when Naaman hears about this, and the king up in Syria hears about this, he sends Naaman off as like top general off to Israel to get healed with like this big entourage of stuff. And that's in verse 5. And he brought a letter to the king of Israel saying, and now as this letter comes to you, behold, I've sent Naaman my servant to you that you may cure him of leprosy. And the king of Israel says, who am I? You know, the heal or kill or whatever. He's looking for an opportunity to make war with me. He's looking to cause trouble. Do non-Christians believe in God more than we do? Because right now, Naaman and his superior believe in God more than the king of Israel believes in God. Do we really believe in God as much as we claim? How would you live if you really, really believed that Jesus was going to show up and you were going to stand before him in judgment and you're going to be judged according to his word and it was an eternal heaven or hell is the result of pass or fail? I mean, what if you really, really believe that? And what if you really, really believe that he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, and there is no other way besides Jesus Christ? And that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Would you talk to any more people this coming week if you really, really believe that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation? And I'm talking to myself as well. So, do we truly, really believe what we're saying and what we're doing? All right, so here's what Naaman is told. Verse 10, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored to you and you will be clean. All right, now, can I digress just a little bit because there's a powerful lesson here. Could he go and wash in another river and be clean? You go like, well, no. Could he go to the Jordan and wash 5 times and be clean? You go like, well, no, that's not what the text says. Okay, so here's the thing. When God is specific, that rules out all other options. The more specific God gets in Scripture, God does not have to pause and say, okay, I told you to wash in the Jordan 7 times. Now, what that means is you can't wash here, 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 and then name every river. And then go through every number. 7 times 7, it's not 5, it's not 6, it's not 20, it's not 144, whatever. Right? The Bible would be a book so big that you couldn't use it if God had to pause at every command and tell you what the command ruled out. Okay, common sense tells you, like you would read or study anything, washing the Jordan 7 times rules out all other rivers besides the Jordan. And it rules out all other number combinations. It rules that out too. It's in the Jordan, and it's 7 times. When God is specific, that rules everything else out. Now, we see that in other passages. I think we saw that in the book of Genesis chapter 6, when Noah is told to build the ark. He is given very precise dimensions. Verse 14 and 15. 300 cubits, 50 cubits, 30 cubits. Any other dimensions are not acceptable. And it's gopher wood. Any other wood is not acceptable.
If someone said, well, it doesn't say you couldn't make it out of another wood, you would go like, no, no, no. That's not the way you reason through something.
When God specifies gopher wood, that rules out every other option. When God specified those dimensions, that rules out all other options.
So I don't need to give you a verse that says that, you know, well, it doesn't say I can't do it like 400 and this and that. Well, don't need a verse for that. The verse says what the dimensions are. Another place that you would find that would be in Leviticus chapter 10. And you might say, well, hey, that sounds pretty good. The thing is that most religious groups do not consistently apply this. That's the problem. They might apply it up to a point. Leviticus chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it, and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded. And then fire comes out and consumes them. Okay, it doesn't say that they offered fire that had been specifically forbidden in some passage. It simply says they offered fire that was not commanded or was not authorized. All right? So when someone says, well, does it say I can't do it? No. Because Nadab and Abihu could have kind of pulled that trick. Well, does it say you can't do it? Okay, but what you offered was unauthorized. Where's the verse that says you can? That's the issue. What's the original command say? Because, like what Naaman, you're not going to say, well, God said wash in the Jordan 7 times. Well, he didn't say I couldn't wash in the Columbia. Okay, you're not going to argue that way. The Jordan rolls out all of the rivers. 7 times rolls out all of the other numbers. We see that also in 2 Samuel chapter 6 when David moves the Ark of the Covenant on a new cart and God's anger is expressed towards Uzzah because he touched it. And later on in Chronicles, David says, the reason that God had an outburst against us is because God did not seek him according to the ordinance. And then David told the Levites, God commanded you guys to carry the ark. That's the original instruction. So when God said back in the book of Numbers that these Levites, this family set of Levites, they carry the ark, that ruled out other options. That God did not have to say, okay, and as a result of that, that means you can't put it on a new cart, or God didn't have to elaborate on that. These men carry it, rule out all other carrying options. So, if sometimes you wonder, for example, I was looking at the website of the Leeward Church of Christ, or and I was looking at comments people left, and there was a few snarky comments there. And one person said, well, they don't use instrumental music in worship. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, of course they don't. I mean, of course they don't, because the command is the same. Complaining about them not using instrumental music would be like complaining about they meet on the first day of the week. Well, yeah, that's the command, Acts 20, verse 7. Or they partake of communion. Well, yeah, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, 23 through 26. In the book of Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19, speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. So, as you go through the verse, speaking to one another would mean that it's congregational in nature, it's congregational singing. Speaking to one another would rule out choirs and soloists, for only part of the congregation sings. So, speaking to one another is a congregational sort of singing. Alright? Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, there's some latitude there, right? That opens up the door for a number of songs, but it closes the door on any song that is not biblically correct. Because that would not be a spiritual song. Alright? So any song that might be purely political or purely entertainment or, you know, purely this or purely that, that really has nothing to do with spiritual truth, is not a song that we're going to sing. Then it says this, making melody, a singing, and making melody with your heart to the Lord. That's specific. Singing is specific. That rules out the plain. Making melody with your heart rules out making the melody like on a guitar or piano. So that's the reasoning behind why we just sing in the assembly. Because the command specifies that. This command, Colossians 3:16, specifies that. And there is no passage in the New Testament that authorizes any other music in the assembly. Okay? So that's kind of what we do, what we do. Let me go another line. You might say, why do you call yourselves the Church of Christ? And you might say, well, Romans 16:16, all the churches of Christ salute you. That's a biblical name, okay? But it's not just that passage. Matthew 16:18, I will build my church. Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church. So what do we call it if it's his church? Acts 20, verse 28. Elders are told to shepherd the church which Jesus purchased with his own blood. So if he bought the church with his own blood, what do we call it? And then my fourth passage would be in Ephesians chapter 5, the wife is to be subject to her husband as the church is subject to Christ. So if the church is the bride of Christ, then what do we call it? And I think those are four passages I would say, you know, I think we can make a pretty strong case that church of Christ, and I know church of God is used in the book of Corinthians, but man, church of Christ, there's at least four passages there that I find that looks like that's not only what we call it, but that's the proper, that gives you the right idea. It's the church, the called out, the assembly that belongs to Christ. Yeah, that's what it is. All right, so hopefully that kind of helps as far as you go through the Bible. Okay, so when we gather together, we're going to gather on the first day of the week because that's specific. And when we gather, the Lord's Supper, that's an assembly, 1 Corinthians 11. And then it's singing, right? Give as you've been prospered, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. That's on the first day of the week. There's preaching, there's prayer. We're the Church of Christ. Each congregation is independent, autonomous. That's 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. That's specific. Elders are the shepherd, the church of God, the flock that's among them. Okay? And so that's the reasoning behind all that we do. When God is specific, we don't ad lib. We respect that. We respect when God is specific. All right. Now, so he's told to do that. Go wash in the Jordan seven times. He is absolutely furious. And maybe for a couple of reasons. Naaman was furious, verse 11, and went away and said, behold, I thought. That can get you in trouble. Behold, I... You need to think, right? You need to think. But thinking that's divorced from Scripture can be really dangerous thinking. Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. And then he is insulted that, well, the rivers up in Damascus are better than the Jordan. Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Here's the thing that strikes me about Naaman. Could you ever forget you were a leper? I would think that would be rather challenging that, you know, I went all day today and I didn't even think about I was a leper. I mean, I think that would be rather challenging to forget you were a leper. It's kind of like forgetting you were a vegetarian. You go to a restaurant, you start to order a steak, your husband says, hey, you're a vegetarian. Oh, I forgot. I don't think you forget about things like that. He's forgotten he's a leper. Here's the thing that strikes me. At this point, Naaman, if he said, Naaman, why did you come here? To see a show. No, you didn't come here to see a show. You came here to get healed of leprosy. A disease that has no cure. a really bad disease too.
That's going to eventually take you out. You're not going to be able to perform your duties anymore. And really complicates your life in all sorts of ways. You've forgotten you're a leper.
Okay, all right.
You know, it's easy to forget your greatest need in life. It's easy to forget what it's all about. I know in the past there have been people that have visited here and walked away like, well, they didn't have this or that, or...
No, you forgot why you came here.
You somehow got the idea that you were coming here to get entertained or you were going to get something, and you forgot. No, the reason I came is I was lost.
Right? The reason I came, I was lost. Sometimes you can get in a Bible study, right? You can get in a Bible study, and maybe someone says, hey, here, Mark, he that believeth and is baptized should be saved. I've seen people get all bent out of shape after they read that passage. And at that moment, they've forgotten their greatest need. Their greatest need is redemption. You argue with baptism, you've forgotten what your greatest need is.
And so, don't forget what your greatest need is. Your greatest need is always to be right with God. Your greatest need is redemption, salvation, deliverance, the forgiveness of your sins. That's your greatest need.
And it's easy to get sidetracked. Something else that impresses me, verse 12.
Well, the rivers up in Damascus are a lot better than Jordan. Maybe so, maybe not. Okay? But sometimes you got to realize what your culture's good at and what your culture's bad at. As a Christian, as I go somewhere, I try to pick the best from all cultures, because as a Christian, I kind of feel like I'm a universal citizen in a sense. I know my citizenship is American, I appreciate that, but at the same time, this is God's world, and so everywhere here is home, because it belongs to God. And so as I travel to whatever I'm going, like, I'm trying to look at what do they do here maybe a little bit better than where I'm from. What can I learn? What can I adapt? But also,
like, if I was living in the islands or preaching in the islands, and everyone's on island time, I think I'd say there's a lot of things I appreciate about your culture, you guys, but one thing that you need to tweak about your culture is that there is a value to being timely. There's a value to that. Sometimes it's so easy to get caught up in your culture that you excuse what is kind of bad behavior because it's a cultural thing. And I think as a Christian, hopefully as a Christian, I can navigate life to say, like, you know, this one thing about our culture stinks. For example, one thing I found really refreshing about the islands, I don't know if I saw one adult business. Strip club, that sort of thing. And so, to the Northwest, I'd say we got way too many of these places. I mean, what are we like addicts or something? I mean, it's pitiful. I'd say that's a pitiful commentary on. We need to get rid of that. Yeah, that's a bad look. That's a really, really bad look. The other thing that really impressed me there is that, yeah, you had trash, or you had some homeless camps, but what I found on Oahu is that when there was trash, it was organized trash. That is, there was some trash, but it was all bagged up and it was waiting for someone to pick it up. It was at least sad. Versus in Portland, where it's strong, you know, all the way. I found that good. And so that's something else I would tell our Northwest culture, that's a bad look. Okay, we need to change that. We're trashing the place. That's not good. We cannot just excuse that and say, that's unique us. No. And so, maybe that's something to keep in mind, okay? The church belongs to Christ. It doesn't belong to the culture. It belongs to Christ. We need to make sure it's what Christ wants it to be. And I think that's the challenge every culture probably goes through is, we don't want this church looking too much like us. We want it looking like Christ.
is what we really want there. Here's something else that struck me is that
Naaman is a really important guy, but Naaman is rescued by the unnamed servant girl, and Naaman is rescued by his servants, that as he's about ready to walk away in a rage, that the servants challenge him in a nice way and say, okay, if you had been asked to do some great thing, like give your firstborn or whatever, you probably would have done it. How much more when he just tells you to go wash in the Jordan 7 times? Part of evangelizing, I think, sometimes is just, part of evangelizing is just questioning people's plan.
When they say like, when they kind of tell you the way they live or the philosophy they live by or whatever, and sometimes it's just good to say, so how's that working for you? Well, you know, I don't need God that much. I can kind of figure it. So how's that working for you? I think it was John's grandfather maybe that would ask people like, he would ask them their life plan like, well, I'm going to get married. What then? What next? He'd keep asking what next. And then they'd say like, well eventually I'm going to die. And he'd say, what next? What's your plan after that? I think that's a good way to kind of, it's a good way that you question, maybe use the word challenge,
but it's a good way that you really ask people a question. Maybe nobody else is asking them that, okay, you told me your plan. Okay, how's that going to work? Because I definitely see some holes in that plan, and you should too. So is that working for you? Is that doing it? Do you need something else? Or are you ready to hear about something else?
And it's almost like that's what the servants do to Naaman. Like, okay, we hear you saying, we hear your argument, but we're going to push back against it. And say, you know, we do not understand the decision you're making right now at all.
Have people in your life, like Naaman had, have people in your life, they don't have to be, you don't have any servants,
have people in your life that when you're about ready to do something like Naaman was going to do, that love you enough to push back and say, can we slow down here? Wait a minute. That doesn't sound good. Have people that surround you like that. So Naaman comes back incredibly humble, wants to give Elisha a gift. Elisha refuses, and then wants a load of earth in verse 17. And in verse 18, he says to the prophet, in this matter may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon, which is the god that was worshipped up there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon the servant in this matter.
I would call that counting the cost and thinking ahead. I don't know about you, but when I heard the gospel the first time, right before I was baptized, as I was thinking about my decision to become a Christian, I know the following thoughts went through my head. Okay, am I prepared? Am I prepared to be there like every Wednesday night, every Sunday night? You know what I mean? I started thinking about my schedule. Okay, if I do this, then this is what it involves. This means I need to be there because I need the instruction. I don't know anything hardly right now, so I need the instruction. I need those Bible classes. I got to catch up. But you started thinking ahead on, okay, and I'm not going to do that, and that anymore. And then I need to start doing that, and that. And it's prayer, and it's Bible study, and I'm a young man, so it's going to be things like eventually giving an invitation and serving on the Lord's table. And it's also going to include things like I'm expected to start talking to other people about Jesus. Am I still willing to be baptized? And I saw this man thinking ahead because what he's saying to the prophet is, hey, when I go back home, one of my duties is, as the king goes in to worship his God, I'm expected to be there holding his hand. And is God going to understand that? Because I know there's nothing to that stuff now. And I know the true God is here. Man. And it's one of those things almost like as he's, you know, he's like a his body's all new again, or his flesh is clean again like a baby, and he's walking back to where, he's going back to where the prophet was, and man, the wheels in his head are turning. And he's putting two to two together and all of that. So,
you know you're ready to be baptized if the wheels in your head are turning like that. And if you're thinking ahead of, okay, yeah, this could mean some changes in my life, and here are the commitments that I need to be prepared to sign off on if I'm going to live the Christian life. And there may be one here this morning who is there this morning like, I'm ready to live the Christian life. When the first Sunday night that we worshiped with the group in Oahu, young man got up to serve communion, and it kind of caught our attention when he got up, because he said, okay, we're going to do the Lord's Supper. And it's like, and I might not do that with the Lord's Supper, but John and us agreed that, okay, now we're going to extend the invitation. I like that attached to the invitation, because it's like, okay, baptistry's ready. He that believeth is baptized shall be saved. Are you saved or are you lost? And how do you want to leave here this morning? And let's be standing and singing the invitation song.